entered the College of Lake County in 2007. Eric worked for 20 years as an aviation meteorologist for a major airline in Chicago and spent 4 years as an Air Force weather officer with tours of duty in Kentucky and Nebraska. As a professor of meteorology, his main goal is to help students become better consumers of weather information. And Eric, thanks so much for being here. Your timing is just perfect with this cold weather we're having out here.
Hey, it didn't work out that way, but thanks for having me, Tim.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And we do want to talk about the current weather. I want to know why I was freezing so much when I was walking the dog this morning. And but there's so many things to talk about, including weather phenomena and all sorts of things that we're going to get into about weather. Let's talk about you for a few moments. Let's just back up. What triggered your interest in meteorology and weather?
You know, I was really into really all the natural sciences as a kid, but one thing I can remember is a snowstorm that hit my area where I grew up in a small town in southern Ohio called Bainbridge in Ross County, and we don't get a lot of snow there, about average about 20 inches a year. And I remember one snowstorm that was not forecast, and I was only about 10 years old, but I remember how different everything looked outside that day versus the day before, and how the landscape dramatically changed. And that really hooked me, and the start was very really mostly in the winter weather initially, because it was very rare to get what we have outside right now there. And that kind of blossomed into starting a lot of thunderstorms, and I started being interested in tornadoes and such like that.
And so we're going to fast forward 8 years later. You go to Penn State University, which is known as its meteorology department.
Yes.
What was that program like? What was it like those 4 years that you were there studying?
Well, it was very rigorous. Some people would say that Penn State's undergrad meteorology program, honestly, is on the level of a graduate level program at other universities. So it was very rigorous. I had to work very hard, but the first 2 years was all preparatory work in mostly math and physics. I took as much math to be a math minor, and I took physics for engineers. And I always tell my students that want to become meteorologists, I say, just so you know, you'll take as much math and physics that an engineer would have to take to become a meteorologist.
Okay, now I've got kind of an amateur question here. Why is that?
Because they want you to understand what goes into the atmosphere. In other words, I'll be honest with you, as a professional meteorologist, I didn't use a lot of the math really on a day-to-day basis, but the math and physics that go into the computer models, they want you to actually understand those differential equations that go into solving the models that all meteorologists use to forecast the weather now, and kind of understand how everything works.
Mm-hmm. So then it became an aviation meteorologist, and what is the primary goal or mission or purpose of an aviation meteorologist?
Well, the reason that my career was steered that way is when I was at Penn State, I was an Air Force ROTC. Mm-hmm. So when I graduated, I was commissioned an Air Force officer, and that part of meteorology is the Air Force flies, right? So that part of meteorology was to forecast the weather specifically for aviation. And how that's different is we have to be able to, an aviation meteorologist has to specifically say things like how high the clouds are, how high the cloud bases are off the ground, how far the horizontal visibility is. You generally
now, aren't pilots trained to do that?
They're trained to be able to read the weather reports, but we had to be able to forecast it in that format. In other words, how high the clouds are, how far the visibility is. An aviation meteorologist has to be more precise, basically. Has to be more precise in when is precipitation going to start, when is it going to stop, how much per hour is the snow going to fall, not just the total amount, but how much per hour, things like that. And precise wind directions, in fact, it's not just enough to say you're going to have a northwesterly wind. It's and you have to forecast in a number of degrees, which is like a 360-degree circle, and be like a northwest wind might be 310 degrees or it might be 330. Makes a difference for airlines.
Okay, I'm trying to understand this job a little bit more. So you're working for United Airlines,
right,
major carrier. A typical day as an aviation meteorologist, I'm thinking United Airlines has a lot of flights.
Yeah.
Now, how does that work? It seems very stressful, almost like an air traffic controller. Or are there a number of aviation meteorologists that handle, say, 10 flights an hour? How does that all, I'm trying to figure this all out.
No, that there's an interim step there called flight dispatch, and they actually would be the ones that talk to the pilots. What we would do, we would generally typically have three people on duty at one time, and we'd split up the country geographically. One person would take half the U.S., the eastern half, one person would take the western half, and one person would take the international. Now, that sounds like a lot, and it is, but what United felt like...
It seems like an awful lot.
If we could get the weather right at the hubs, all the airlines have hubs. I've been out of aviation for 9 years, but it used to be United had, when I was there, they had two eastern hubs, Washington, D.C., and Chicago, and they had two western hubs, Denver and San Francisco. And internationally, we would have a big number of flights at London, Frankfurt, Germany, Paris, but also Tokyo, Hong Kong, Sydney, Australia, Auckland, New Zealand. At least in the United States, if we get the weather right, the hubs. So the eastern forecasts are mostly forecast, but mostly concentrate on Chicago and Washington, D.C. The western forecasts are Denver and San Francisco. And the international forecasts are wherever the weather problems were, basically. You can't forecast the whole world in one day. So if the problems were in Europe, you'd focus on Europe. The problems were, say, a typhoon hitting Tokyo, focus on that day.
Must be a lot of stress, I would think, because weather is stressful, particularly for a pilot. So I'm thinking wind shear and all sorts of things is coming to my mind.
Yeah, the stress came into the forecast that would be for snowstorms, for instance, or big events, for instance. Like, you forecast a snowstorm in Chicago, that's going to trigger major decisions by the airline at O'Hare. Like, if you forecast a snowstorm, they have to cancel flights. In advance, cancel flights, you're talking about a lot of money. If the snow doesn't happen, then they come at you. Well, why didn't you forecast so much snow? If you don't forecast it and it does happen, that's even worse. So the pressure was to be precise in an imprecise science, basically.
Is that a normal job, though? I mean, you work in all sorts of hours, or how does that?
Oh, it was rotating shifts. Mm-hmm. Rotating days off. Kind of a brutal schedule. For 15 years, I was on a schedule of 5 days on, 2 days off, 5 afternoons on, 2 days off, 5 midnights, and then back to days a few days later. It's a game for the young, basically.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, you know, really, trying to sleep with rotating shifts was tough.
Yeah. What was your most memorable experience being an aviation meteorologist?
Well, of course, you like to remember the ones you get, but I do remember ones I missed, too. I can remember one in the 1980s where I just started there I worked in the night shift, and I forecast the snowstorm for O'Hare based on one of the models that was incorrect, and woke up the next day and it was sunny. So I was not happy about that one. But I do remember the hits we had. One of them was a big one. If you may remember, after New Year's in 1999, we had a huge blizzard in Chicago. Mm-hmm. We had over 20 inches or so, and we had actually forecasted that well in advance. Did a very good job on as a department, and I was able to cancel flights and then start back up very quickly where some other airlines were not. So you remember things like that. Some of the really weird things that you never think that a meteorologist would get involved in, volcanic ash for one thing.
1992,
yeah. There was a volcano that went off in Alaska. Mm-hmm. Volcanoes go off all over the world a lot, more than you hear about. But this one took ash up to flight level where jets fly at, and the jet stream blocked that ash down over the continental United States. And so for a while there, it was pretty hairy whether flights were going to be able to operate or not. Because if a flight flies through volcanic ash, it can destroy the engines and it can be a catastrophe. But fortunately, when the ash came down to this area, and actually there was a pocket of ash just north of Chicago in southern Wisconsin, 2 days later after that volcano. Thousands of miles is that away from the volcano?
Yeah.
But the ash was diffuse enough by that time that they could actually fly right through it, and it wasn't a problem.
But it was very eerie, and it created a lot of cloud cover, if I recall.
The sky had a really yellowish, brownish look to it.
Yeah.
And you can know it. It's the only time I've ever
like you're on
seen,
Mars or something.
Like the only time I've ever really seen was what's legitimate volcanic ash in the sky was that morning after several days later after that eruption.
No, you saw that in Chicago.
I was driving home to Lake County. I can see that the sky in the distance in the northern sky had that yellowish brownish look to it.
creepy.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, what are some key factors in determining a weather forecast? So we've been talking about, you know, being an aviation meteorologist. When you're deciding or determining or predicting, whatever word you want to use, what are the data that you look at that is key?
Well, there's a lot of things you look at, and a successful meteorologist has to put together a lot of data and analyze it to come up with a decision on what the thing is going to happen. Surface data, for one thing, surface observations all around the country, different locations, for instance, around here.
Surface locations, just what the eye sees?
Airports, basically. Okay. You know, airports would have observations, like Kenosha would have one, Waukegan has one, Milwaukee Airport has one, Rockford has one. All these observations all around the country has come in every hour, so we can look at that data and analyze it for things like fronts, centers of low pressure areas, centers of high pressure, where the precipitation is. That's one area. The other areas we have that not only do we sense horizontally, but we sense vertically too. Certain stations around the country will send up weather balloons every 12 hours. They're called radiosondes, but they basically radiosondes are the name because they radio back the weather information as they go up. And
I like weather balloon.
That sounds better. Yeah, that's a much bigger sensor to see, much easier. That's what it is. But they send back information on winds, temperature, moisture, and pressure at different levels in the atmosphere. So it's not enough to just know what's going on horizontally. You have to know what's going on vertically as well, because everything that happens at the surface weather-wise is controlled by what happens in the upper part of the atmosphere.
Okay, get the vertical. That's weather balloons. Mm-hmm. Back to the horizontal.
Yes.
I'm going to be like the student in the back of your class that just keeps asking questions.
I love that.
Okay, so I'm not sure if I understand the horizontal. Does that mean just observing from a tower?
I'm
lost.
Horizontal, what I mean is on the surface. On the surface, yeah. So we can analyze data at all these different surface.
Okay, all right. So whatever moisture you have at the surface.
Exactly.
Okay.
Wind, moisture, temperature, pressure, cloud cover, that kind of stuff.
Okay, another dumb question. How far is the surface for a meteorologist? I mean, is it just like, 20 feet, 30 feet?
The weather stations are typically about 6 feet off the ground.
6 feet, okay.
Yeah, about that, yeah.
So that's where.
Typically now at CLC, the weather stations we have, the only place I can put them is really up on the roofs.
Okay.
But we're not talking about like hundreds of feet off the ground. We're talking about, much at most tens of feet. But the official National Weather Service stations are about 6 feet off the ground.
Okay, so I'd like to be an amateur weatherman without having to take all your difficult math and physics.
No, you mean amateur meteorologist, right?
Right. Oh, okay. Sorry. Okay. Meteorologist. Okay, so what are some simple tips to aid us amateurs like myself in predicting the weather? I'm thinking like some basic terminology. We hear the TV folks talk about dew point, barometric pressure, wind speed, all this. I understand all that is kind of combined into it. Then you have your weather models, and you get into that other level, and weather balloons and so on and so forth that we're learning about. But what are some easy predictors, I should say, for the amateur?
Well, one of the things I think is really important to understand is I'm glad you brought up the dew point, because I really drive this home in my class. The dew point is a much better indicator of your comfort level outside, more than relative humidity. Really, it really should never have been picked up by the media to tell people how uncomfortable they are, because all it tells you is how close the air is to saturation. What you really want to know is how much moisture is in their air, because the more moisture there is in the air, the more uncomfortable you feel. So some of the better TV meteorologists that are on in Chicago area, like Tom Skilling, for instance, will use the dew point, and it's basically the temperature that the air must cool to reach saturation. But really, all you have to really know is, I find that it starts to get uncomfortable when the dew point gets to 65, and it gets really uncomfortable when the dew point gets to 70, and when it gets to be 75, it gets to be really stifling, and that's when you start to see heat advisories or advisories for elderly or whatever to really watch their exertion and things like that.
So 60 would be comfortable.
65. 60 would be okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to go lower than the 65.
Yeah. 65. It's all based on the individual, really what they feel like. But I find that 65, you start to feel uncomfortable a little bit. 70, the discomfort level starts to increase. And by 75, it's stifling.
What's optimum then?
Oh, well, it really depends. You could probably say it's pretty dry out there today. And, for instance, the dew point right now is 7 below zero right now. And it's pretty dry out there. I don't but it's pretty dry, and there's very, very little absolute moisture in the atmosphere. A day when in the summer when the dew points are down to 50s is a really nice day.
Okay, 50s.
Yeah, 50s in the summer. You know, this, what happens is as you go into the warm season, the air gets warmer, the air can hold more moisture, and the Gulf of Mexico starts to warm up, and we get winds off the Gulf of Mexico, and that's where we get that really high humidity from. In the wintertime, as the air gets colder, the colder air can't hold as much moisture, the dew point goes way down. So we don't really, really worry about the dew points in the wintertime. It's a summertime factor.
Low pressure and high pressure. Now, I always assume that low pressure means not so good weather, and high pressure means pretty nice weather.
It depends on what you look at, what you're thinking of. But low pressure absolutely means you've got a higher risk of clouds and precipitation coming in, because what's happening is with low pressure, you're decreasing the amount of air in the column. And when you do that, the air tends to rise. When the air, with rising air cools, condenses, if it's lifted high enough, and forms clouds. And if clouds are thick enough, you'll have precipitation from that. So low pressure systems are associated with rising air, and thus mostly clouds and precipitation. Whereas high pressure, higher density of air, that's associated with air actually sinking. So air sinking is going to want to dry out, and that's when you tend to get your clear skies, very little precipitation and clouds.
So in a little bit of an oxymoron, we've had this very frigid weather this past week, but nice blue skies.
Well, and that's what you're going to have.
So what's the deal there?
Well, the deal is, it depends what you see. This is nice weather, right? You don't like cold weather, but when you're cold.
Right, we've had frigid weather, and then it's beautiful. Oh, wow, look at it. It was, not cloud in the sky.
Your coldest days are going to be with your clearest skies.
Right, exactly.
Because it's your high pressure factor, the highest pressure I've seen.
So the high pressure doesn't always mean.
High pressure in the wintertime means cold air, because cold air is very dense.
Right.
But you're not getting clouds of precipitation from that. In fact, the high pressure that we had yesterday has moved off to the east. Now we have a weak low pressure coming down that's going to bring us some snow today and tonight.
Which I want to talk about in a certain segment. Yeah, I want to spend a lot of time on the current weather. A little bit of some other basic terminology. Okay, we didn't talk about barometric pressure.
Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. We're talking pressure, yeah.
Okay.
So
too much pressure is bad, whether it's dew point or barometric pressure.
Wait a minute.
I'm trying to dumb this down.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about types of clouds.
Okay.
And we're going to switch to summer for a minute.
Okay.
So, because we're going to talk about winter in a few minutes here, and the current temperature and the current weather forecast. But in the summer, if I see high gray clouds, this is what I remember from fourth grade, by the way, does that mean we've got some bad weather coming? If they're high and gray.
That actually doesn't work well in the summer.
Let's call it nimbus?
No, those are the high gray clouds. What you're thinking about is other stratus clouds,
Matter
clouds.
Okay, all right.
They give the grayish skies. That works well in the wintertime. If you've got a low-pressure system approaching, well out ahead of the low-pressure system, you've got air rising to high levels of the atmosphere, and you actually saturate the air high levels first. You see those wispy cirrus clouds.
Yes, the wispy.
The wispy.
Wispy means rain coming.
Well, wispy, it can. If it's just got a low-pressure system approaching. Again, this only works in the winter. It will not work in the summer. And as you get closer to the low, the clouds lower and thicken. Sometimes you'll see the sun dimly visible through the clouds, or maybe a halo around the sun, or a halo around the moon, for instance.
Yes.
And you hear some of these old adages, well, that means you're going to have precipitation in 12 or 18 hours. And that works if you've got a low-pressure system approaching. So that's one of those adages that actually kind of works from that. But that does not work well in the summertime because the lows are really too weak really to cause it. But you still can get the high-grade clouds. They may or may not be associated with a low, though.
Now, the adages or the cliches, one of them that I have here in front of me, red sky at night, sailor's delight. Red sky in morning, sailors take warning.
Yeah,
is there some truth to these cliches or adages or folklore?
Well, to that one there is. But again, it works well in the wintertime. for instance, if you've got a red sky in the morning, that means you've got clear skies on the eastern horizon to allow the sun's rays to come up, and then if the clouds are actually approaching from the west, we know most of our weather systems approach from the west or the east.
Mm-hmm.
So that would mean Sailor's Day morning means you've got clouds and precipitation probably coming in your area. Red sky at night, Sailor's Delight. Well, red sky at night, that means you have clear skies on the western horizon coming up, and the sun's rays coming up, hitting clouds that are actually retreating. Mm-hmm. Going away from you, where you have clear skies coming in, meaning the weather's going to be okay the next day. So there is some truth to that.
There is some truth to that
one. Yeah, it doesn't, but like a lot of things, almost everything in winter, it doesn't work all the time. But especially in the wintertime with major systems, it would work, yeah.
Maybe that segues to this. What is the most difficult thing about forecasting and being a meteorologist?
Well, I mean, if you're a perfectionist, like I try to be, and working in an imperfect science, it can get very frustrating. You can't be perfect all the time. And, you know, weather forecasting is not perfect. It's improved a lot over the years. But we don't still have the ability to know for sure what's going to really happen, even 24 hours out. I mean, the probability is going way up. I mean, I always tell my classes, the accuracy that we have now at 5 days out is what it was when I got into meteorology about 48 hours out. So it's gone from 2 days to 5 days. It's improved quite a bit from that. So a 24-hour forecast, we're pretty confident of, but there's still things that can happen to mess that up.
So 5 days, if you see a five-day forecast, what is the probability percentage-wise?
Well, it depends really on accuracy. I mean, it depends really what you're measuring. I know you don't have numbers on five
reliability,
days,
I guess I'm talking about.
But, you know, like, for instance, at 24 hours out, when I was at United, our accuracy was in the high 80s, high 80%. So that's pretty good at 24 hours out. But, you know, the thing is once you get further out, you start to talk more in general terms. Like, I would never make a forecast about what is today, Thursday, for Sunday. I would never tell you today that it's going to start snowing at 2 o'clock and it's going to stop at 7. I could look out Sunday and say, well, maybe the snow will come in. It looks like snow is going to probably come in the afternoon and be out in the evening. But that could change quite a bit in the next couple of days. So we start talking in more general terms. So your verification of that would be a more verification level. If you're verifying a five-day forecast 5 days out right now, if I say there's a risk of snow, if there's snow likely, you know, 5 days out and it happens, that's a verification, regardless of what time it happens, regardless of how much. But 24 hours out, you know, you want to know specifics, like when's it going to start, when's it going to stop, how much we're going to get, that kind of thing.
I was watching the Weather Channel yesterday. They had a seven-day forecast. What are your observations about that? Sounds like you're stuck on the 5 day pretty much.
Well,
I mean, stuck, but that in terms of accuracy. So I'm seeing 7 day.
Yeah, you know, not only that.
Are there any percentages there? I mean, 40% are accurate, or is it?
I think it's 7 days out. I would think the accuracy is probably less than 40%, to be honest with you. I talk about current weather in all my classes. We always look at the models, and we always look at what the forecast is going to be. And I tell my class, I don't like going out beyond 7 days because the errors start to compound in the computer models and the equations. They compound over time, and when you get too far out, the model basically just becomes junk.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the models will go out 15 days. So I'm still going to make a 15-day
forecast
sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's fantasy land. I mean, really, we don't, beyond 7 days, you really don't know, you know, really what for sure what's going to happen. You kind of get an idea of the trend, and it's going to get colder, it's going to get warmer, but specifics, not so much.
So 24 hours is about as good as it gets.
Well, no, I'm not saying that. Okay. 24 hours for specifics, but I would have pretty good accuracy out of 5 days, but again, it gets more general as you go further out.
Okay.
Yeah.
I am talking to Eric Priest, professor of meteorology and earth science at the College of Lake County. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Eric regarding the current weather, weather phenomena, and the CLC weather station. You're listening to Word of Mouth, and we'll be back right after this. Compact your snow on the ground. Simon and Garfunkel, that's Hazy Shade of Winter, and you're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Jim Wunderlich, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking to Eric Priest, professor of meteorology at the College of Lake County, former aviation meteorologist for 20 years, and we've been talking about all sorts of things, weather terminology, weather phenomena. We're going to continue on that merry way doing that. And we're going to talk about a little bit about, we were both going for the water bottles here over the break. And I said, boy, the dew point here must be pretty awful. I think you said, what was the percentage?
I got to believe if you heat the air outside up to 70 degrees or whatever the room is, it's got to be about 1% in here.
Yeah, so that's why we're so raspy and dry skin and everything else. And, you know, we were talking about also barometric pressure and what we can do, you know, without having to go to Penn State University and get a master's degree in atmospheric science and so on and so forth, what we can do just with some amateur tips. And one thing, let's go back to the barometric pressure. If we have a barometer at home, how can we use that?
Well, it's pretty simple, really. You know, first of all, on a home barometer, called an aneroid barometer, where you have dials and things, there are words on that barometer, and the words mean nothing. where I've seen it rain when it says very dry, and I've seen it dry when it says rain. But what you really want to take a look at is where is that needle going over time, like a long-term trend, like a day or a day and a half. If the trend of that needle is falling, in other words, moving to the left, that means pressure's falling, you probably have a low pressure system approaching, which means you've got a better chance of clouds precipitation. Mm-hmm. If the barometer is rising, if that needle is going to the right, consistently, I'm going to say consistently, at least over the next day or so, you've got high pressure approaching, and that means you'll have fewer clouds and less precipitation.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah. Again, those kind of things work well in the wintertime.
I keep coming back to that
because the pressure systems are much stronger in the wintertime. Than they are in the summer. So in the summertime, it's more real subtle things that cause your days when you have thunderstorms and days when you don't, basically.
Well, I tell you, a lot of people have wanted me to ask this. We're experiencing exceptionally cold weather right now. What is the primary cause of the frigid temperatures that we're having?
Well, this is
normal for winter. I understand that. But,
dare I use the term that was overused last year called the polar vortex.
So that's not just hype.
No. Well, yes, it is hype.
I thought that was a media thing.
Well, that term has been in meteorology forever, but meteorologists talk about it amongst meteorologists, and last year somehow the media got a hold of it and took a life on its own.
Yeah, it's got this graphic design on TV, like with little icicles and stuff. Oh, my God, the polar vortex is coming. Okay, let's talk about the polar vortex.
Yeah, it's a big, large upper-level low-pressure system over, it typically is near the poles, and in December it mostly was. But it came down over southeastern Canada over the last, I don't know how many days we've been in this now, 3 or 4 days or whatever. And what happens is, well, really, really cold weather. Don't forget what December was like.
Right.
It was pretty nice.
But
what happens is we get, when that polar vortex sets up over southeastern Canada, that brings northerly flow directly across the poles from Siberia, bringing in the coldest air, really, in the northern hemisphere. Now, we don't have it here in Chicago, the coldest air, but the coldest air is up in Canada. But that's the source of that air, and we call that continental Arctic air when we get down as cold as we've gotten. You know, and fortunately, that looks like that's going to relax here and move a little further north, and our winds, our flow, instead of coming off the poles, is going to be coming from more over southwestern Canada and then eventually over western United States, which will be a warmer pattern, basically, by really starting really toward the weekend. I mean, really, Sunday we saw it ought to finally get in the 20s. I know that doesn't sound like
that
great.
That sounds fine.
It sounds great right now. It's
great.
You know, bad skin, but next week we should be in the 20s, mostly near normal. Really, the average high today is 28, average low is 12, and we should be pretty close to that next week. And toward the end of next week, you know, I don't like going beyond 7 days, but looking at out next Thursday, it looks like we could be up near 30 or so.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
I know.
Time to wash the car.
Right. Go on. It's not that right. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit. By the way, you said Siberia. So polar vortex, if I hear Siberia, I'm thinking Gulag and everything else. This
well, the coldest air in the northern hemisphere forms over Siberia because it's a large landmass and a high latitude, low sun angle, so it stays dark, and it just gets colder and colder and colder over the winter, and that's really the source of the coldest air in the northern hemisphere comes from there. Turns out the North Pole, that's not usually where the coldest air is because there's actually the Arctic Ocean there, and there's cracks in the sea ice that actually warm up that air. Now, it's not like tropical air, but it's warmer than what the air over the large land masses would be.
Okay. Okay, so if I hear Siberia, we're going to have some problems.
Yeah, a lot of times, before the polar vortex term, one term I heard for these really strong Arctic air masses was Siberian Express. Right, that's what it is. You hear that?
Okay, wind chill.
Okay.
You know, it seems a little bit like hype to me, because when I was growing up, Eric, I don't remember wind chill. I just remember it would be people would say, yeah, it's going to be 6 below 0, Johnny, or whatever. And now everything's wind chill, wind chill, wind chill. But as a meteorologist, what are your feelings about the term wind chill?
Well, it's significant. First of all, wind chill only affects living things. Wind chill will not affect the radiator of the car at all or anything like that. But what it'll do is it'll cool your skin due to evaporation, basically. It'll cool it. Evaporation is a cooling process, and it's like getting out of a swimming pool. You feel colder because you have moisture evaporating off your skin. The wind will actually evaporate moisture off your skin. Plus, the wind will actually, through conductive effects, actually cool your skin as well. So it's definitely not something you want to take lightly. We used to actually forecast wind chills when I was at United for the crews that would be at certain airports like O'Hare. I always tell my class, believe it or not, wind chills could delay your flight. You wouldn't think it would. But the guys that are handling the bags outside can only be out so long when you have wind chills. For instance, if we had like wind chills yesterday, down near minus 30, I think we got to. You're down in the area where you could expose flesh could freeze, and your frostbite could happen within 10 minutes, exposed flesh. So I always tell my students, it's easy. We go from our house to the car, and you have one car, and then you go from your car to school or whatever, and you're outside long. But if something happens to you, you got to be outside, or you want to be able to cover up your skin, if you're going to be out for any kind of length of time, because it happens,
So it's not just hype, and wind chill itself, is it just addition? Temperature plus
wind.
That's basically it.
The stronger the temperature, the wind. For instance, right now, at the CLC weather station, we've got a wind chill of minus 14. Fahrenheit. So that's the real feel, what it feels like.
It's minus 14.
Right, and the temperature, the air temperature is 1 above.
Okay.
Yeah.
So right now the wind speed is at what?
Wind speed right now is running at 9 miles an hour.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So you take that and the temperature, and there's charts out there that'll show. The worst wind chills that I've seen around here in a while were a year ago. In fact, a year ago this week. Remember, we actually had wind chills down there, minus 40 or slightly below that.
Right.
Talking about some serious issues when you get down there if you've got any kind of exposed flesh. But, again, if you're dressed well and you're prepared for it, you'll be okay to be out, and if you just, you got to make sure your skin's covered.
Speaking of current weather, what do we have going on later today?
Well, we've got you've got a band of smoke coming in. Something we call in meteorology an Alberta Clipper. It's a weak low-pressure system coming out of Canada with this cold Arctic flow that we have. Again, you get this northwest flow. You get these upper air disturbances that come down that actually cause the air to rise. And so we're going to have some snow break out here. In fact, it's already hit the radio station now. I'm looking out the window right now. And that's going to be, we've got a band of snow really this afternoon. And we could get a quick inch or two really this afternoon. And then maybe a little bit of a break and then maybe another batch. Late in the afternoon, early evening, so that we're probably going to end up with 1 to 3 inches of very dry, fluffy snow, much like what we had the other day.
So the probability, we were talking about that in the first segment, are we talking 85-90% sure about that?
I'm very confident,
Okay.
Highly confident we're going to get that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so it gets to be around 100% in just a few hours.
We call that mountcasting.
Mountcasting.
I'm looking at radar right now, and I see the radar returns in northwest Illinois and actually coming over northeastern Illinois. So it's already happening. It's already out there.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
So where is the snow falling right now?
Oh, well, actually, it was a few minutes ago falling outside the station. But
okay.
The station's nearby. Burlington, Wisconsin is 3/4 mile in light snow. Janesville, Wisconsin is actually 1 mile in moderate snow. Moderate snow means it's falling at a rate of 1 inch an hour. So it's a pretty good band developing.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
And speaking of snowfall, last winter we had a record snowfall.
Mm.
What conditions can we expect this winter? I mean, I know we're talking about predicting, 7 days and all that, but I used to own a farmer's almanac.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering, what are meteorologists in general looking at a, you know, as bad a winter that we had last year in terms of snowfall, or, and by the way, bad can be good if you're a skier and that type of thing. More snow, less snow, early spring, late spring.
Well, let's put it this way. Last year at this time, we already had 38 inches of snow here.
Right.
This year, before today's snow, we've only had 7. So I think the likelihood, unless we would happen to get a big blizzard sometime in February or whenever, that we're going to be less than last year, looks very likely.
Okay.
Because we lost December pretty much, didn't have much in December, and we really haven't had a snowstorm yet. I mean, I think we still potentially could. But looking out 7 days, I didn't see anything coming up, any major storms. That said, I personally don't have a lot of faith in anything, in any long-range forecasting that we can do. I mean, for instance, this winter has flip-flopped so much. Do you remember November?
Yes.
How unbelievably cold it was. The coldest November I've ever experienced here since I've lived here since 1986. And then completely turned around in December where we had a westerly flow and mild temperatures. Now we're back into colder, but it looks like we're trending more toward more normal conditions next week. Doesn't mean we'll go back into cold like we did. You know, this week we'll get back into some of that cold in February, but all in all, I think the odds are that we're probably going to, we should be above normal, a bit above normal in temperature from last year. Not above normal, but a bit above temperatures from last year and less snowfall. But to go beyond that and say what kind of spring we're going to have, it's a toss-up, honestly. I mean, we don't have the skill at this point to go out that far yet and be able to say what it's going to do.
Now, you made that pretty clear.
Yeah.
I want to go back, but you just mentioned November and snowfall. Buffalo.
Oh, yeah.
Very interesting. I guess they had 88 inches when it was all said and done.
Some of the areas around here.
Around Buffalo. Yeah, metropolitan, exactly. Or metro area.
Yeah.
Now, interesting. It was real quirky because when it first fell, there was 4 inches reported near the airport, mm-hmm. the Buffalo airport, and then 70 inches 4 or 5 miles away.
Yeah.
Now, that's an interesting anomaly, and I have to ask why.
Well, that's how lake effect is. It's very lake effect forms in these very narrow bands, but in the band itself.
That's really incredible.
Oh, it is, but that's how it is. I mean, we don't get lake effect too often around here. I don't know this season if we've had any, maybe one day early or not, but when you get in, if you're in a lake effect band, it's a whiteout condition. So, I mean, it could be snowing 3 to 4 inches an hour. 4 or 5 miles away, it could be sunny. That's how narrow these bands are. And it's very difficult to forecast because the wind direction, a small change in wind direction, is going to move the band 3 or 4 miles away, and now they're going to get the heavy snow, and the other places that we're getting it is going to stop. So that's why, and this band was very persistent in a very Arctic air mass. I imagine, I haven't been watching the Buffalo weather, but I imagine they've been getting more in that area off of Lake Erie over this particular time. However, for lake effect snow, the best lake effect snow is going to occur in the late fall, like November, December, because you want the water to still be very warm. And you want the biggest difference between the water temperature and the air coming across at about 5,000 feet. The bigger the difference is, the stronger the lake effect snow can actually be. This time of year, the lake is all cooling by now, so the air actually has to be even colder than it was before. So the biggest lake effect events typically are in the November and December time frames.
Now, the lake effect is interesting in our area, too,
mm-hmm.
in the Chicago area, Indiana, Michigan, along the shore area. They just seem to just get drenched.
Michigan and City, Indiana, not too far from here, maybe a two-hour drive from where we are, twice as much snow as what we get here in Lake
Yes,
County.
Yes.
Because the winds, and here's the reason, is because when these cold air masses come in, the wind direction is typically from the west or the northwest. It's not from the northeast. The wind for Lake County, you get the winds would have to be northeast. It's not typically that direction. It's mostly from the west or northwest, which means on the downwind side of Lake Michigan is going to be northwest Indiana, southwestern Michigan, basically. Downwind side of Lake Erie is going to be over in northwest Pennsylvania and southwestern New York State.
And that's pretty consistent every winter. Mm-hmm. For the most part.
Well, because when your cold air masses come in, they come in with a westerly direction, west or northwest. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you have a quote that I thought was interesting. I was reading a website. Nobody goes into meteorology because they want to forecast sunshine.
That's true.
And that's an interesting statement.
Let's put it this way. I didn't go into it before that session.
Is that true of most meteorologists? I mean, you guys get this adrenaline rush when there's a polar vortex or a hurricane or whatever's going on. And
pretty interesting group of people.
Really. Yeah.
Yeah, it is an adrenaline rush. I mean, you know, I mean, for instance, when there's a snowstorm going on around here, you know, you get pumped up about it. I do. I've got a colleague that teaches at McHenry County College. His name's Paul Hamill, actually, out there. And he and I are friends, and we talk back and forth all the time about the weather. And we talk sometimes 3 or 4 in the morning if the snow is falling at that time. We'll call each other and look at this. Watch this. What's this going on? Was it just an observation? Do the radars in that band? That kind of stuff. So, yeah, you get really pumped up about it.
So if you're a weatherman and or meteorologist, sorry about that.
That's all right.
Well, some have the AMS seal and some don't, I noticed.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting thing. The AMS seal basically means you're a meteorologist.
Yeah, or you have enough meteorological training that the American Meteorological Society would say that you you can get that seal, basically. So and the main reason for that is that, you know, 40, 50 years ago, when the weather guy was on TV, it was basically almost a joke. When I said weather guy, weather gal, it was pretty much a joke. Almost the weather would, and still the weather always follows a lead story. If you watch the news, it still does because, and that's historically been that way because, you know, forecasting was not that great, you know, before the computer models in the 60s and 50s. Mm-hmm. So they would always have a weather guy, and it usually be a gag kind of thing. For instance, when Tom Skilling started on the TV and Milwaukee back in the 70s, he actually had a puppet with him that he used.
WITI.
Oh, so you know,
that's right. College, I would say him with a puppet.
Yeah, now you think about that, right? Yeah. I mean, now you think about what he is now and how scientific his presentation is.
He's actually scientific then.
Yeah.
I think he was very uncomfortable.
Well, I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure. So it's improved a lot over the years in that.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're a meteorologist in San Diego, you can't be getting that rush that you're getting if you're in Chicago. I mean, it would seem to be kind of dull. Well, like 85 and sunny tomorrow.
Well,
more of the same.
Funny story about that. When I was in Hawaii about 20 years ago, you want to talk about a place where the weather doesn't change much.
Yeah.
And it's almost like I listen to the forecast every day, and it's almost like it was on repeat. You know, and the guy didn't sound really excited much about it at all. I certainly would never want to be a meteorologist in a place like San Diego or even the West Coast. But I have forecasted the West Coast weather before. And, of course, from an aviation standpoint, there was a lot of tricky parts to that. You're not going to get major thunderstorm outbreaks or major snowstorm outbreaks, you know, in places like that where you wouldn't in Chicago, obviously.
More of a buzz here.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Jim Wunderlich, and I'm talking to Eric Priest, aviation meteorologist and professor of meteorology and earth science at the College of Lake County. We'll be back right after this. Yeah, heat wave, huh? Yeah, that's Martha and Vandellas, and Love is Like a Heat Wave from the 1960s. And actually, Eric, we're talking to Eric Priest, by the way, for just joining us. Aviation meteorologist and professor of meteorology and earth science at the College of Lake County. And, boy, we've talked about all sorts of things dealing with meteorology and the weather. And there is going to be a little bit of a heat wave coming up here in just a bit. So I think you said we'd be looking at temperatures possibly around 30 in the days ahead.
Well, yeah, so days ahead. As in, I think we'll get in the 20s finally on Sunday. And then we should be 20s most of the week. And towards the end of next week, we should be close to freezing or above, I think.
Which is wonderful.
Yeah. When we have average time is 28, so that actually would be slightly above normal.
Exactly. And we were talking about, if you're just joining us, the first segment we talked a lot about weather terminology. In the second segment, we got into weather phenomena. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about weather phenomena. And we talked a little bit about the Buffalo snowstorm and winter. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the difference between a cyclone, hurricane, and typhoon. And those types of conditions are interesting. What is the difference between those three?
You know, the only difference is where they form.
That's it, huh?
They're all the same thing, yeah. In fact, the hurricanes, the terminology is in the Atlantic and in the eastern Pacific. west of the International Dateline, in the northern Pacific, they're typhoons. Same thing, it's just a different nomenclature.
Mm-hmm.
In the southern Pacific, they are called cyclones. And also, as I understand, in the Indian Ocean, the Indian Ocean's the only ocean I never forecasted anything for. I believe there's cyclones there as well.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
They're all the same thing.
And why do hurricanes and so on and so forth, why do they have names?
I think they were given names just so that they could remember the storms by. A couple hundred years ago, at least 200 or 300 years ago, they were actually named after saints. A lot of islands were christened after saints.
Mm-hmm.
Really, up until 1950, there really were no names. In fact, sometimes you'll hear the Weather Channel talk about the no-name storm of 1938 that hit New York City. It was very, very, you know, very, very devastating, but it didn't have a name. In 1950, they were given names. 50 to 52, I think, they went with phonetic alphabet, Alpha, Beta, Charlie, that kind of thing. And then in 52 on until 78, I believe, they used, or 79, they used female names.
Right.
And then women's rights movement came out in the 1970s and didn't like that too much. And so then became men and male and female names. And so you'll have it now where it'll be a male name, then a female name, then a male name, then a female name. It'll always start as A. The first system name system of the season will be called an A name. And then it'll be then a C and so forth on down. And then at the beginning of the next year, they'll start over with an A again.
Who determines the name?
Well, the National Hurricane Center does. Those names are already picked 5 years out.
Oh.
Now, if there is a very significant hurricane like Katrina, for instance,
yes,
they will retire the name. That name will never be used again.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Makes sense. So just then, I think they use names just so they can remember the storm by. Like, for instance, I mean, if you use the August 2005 storm, people might not think of it too much, but as soon as you say the word Katrina,
yes,
people remember that hurricane. Or Sandy, for instance, that hit a couple years ago.
From the historic perspective.
Exactly. Yeah.
You mentioned the weather station at CLC just in the first segment. How'd that all come about?
Well, I was hired full-time, actually. I was part-time in 2007, but when I was hired at College of Lee County in 2008, I was hired to start a meteorology program. And so I want students to use live weather in my classes. But also, I want there to be a public, where the public can actually go and have one-stop shopping for any weather information they might want. So I set up, I had two weather stations put up. One was put up on the top of the A building at the Graves Lake campus. And then a year later, I had one put up on the top of the roof at the South Lake campus in Vernon Hills. And so it's a weather station that does live weather every 5 minutes, I believe, on the weather website, but temperature, good point.
Talk a little about the website. So if I want to get the current weather, not so much from the Weather Channel, this is really specific to my area. I see you're going to it right now. What is the website?
Well, the website, first of all, if you want to find the one at Grace Lake, I've got to work on getting a better link set up. If you go to the main College of Lake County site and you search for science links, you'll see the weather come up from there, and you can click on the weather, and that'll bring you to the Grays Lake weather website. The South Lake campus weather website is pretty easy. If you go to South Lake campus,
and that's Vernon Hills.
Vernon Hills.
And we found that just a few miles can make a difference when it comes to weather conditions.
So if you want to get to that one, just go to the South Lake campus on the CLC weather website, and you'll see a button there for weather. Just click that, and you can get to it. But what the weather station gives, it gives you current temperature, wind chill, road humidity, dew point, pressure, wind speed, and I've got wind direction at the South Lake campus, and then also rainfall total. But I've also got under there a lot of links where people, if they want to find the current National Weather Service forecast, which I would always recommend that anyone in the public get to, because these guys are trained meteorologists, and they forecast, and they're there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all the time. And you also can get watches and warnings, current watches and warnings out. And likewise, I've got places where you can get the current surface map of the United States and then current radar data over Chicago. You can open that up and looking at that all the time during the interview. And then also satellite data from there as well.
And again, again, we can expect this afternoon a little bit of snow, it's kind of, we'll go ahead.
It can snow pretty hard for a couple hours.
Okay.
And I think we could pick up potentially an inch or two from that, and then a little break, and then there's another shot later in this afternoon, early evening, where we could get another inch. So I've been telling people 1 to 3 inches, I think, of very light snow from this. Of light, when I say light, dry snow, fluffy snow, and windy, and it's literally blowing around and stuff. Very similar to the snow event that we had a few days ago.
We were talking about probability earlier and predictability and percentages and that type of thing, reliability. And you were saying that really the first 24 hours we can pretty much get a handle on it, or
yes,
a meteorologist can.
Right.
And then when we get into the 5-day, it gets a little hazy. That's pretty good now. It's come a long way, as you said, over the years.
Yeah, the accuracy's improved immensely. Like when I first started meteorology, I hated going out beyond 2 days even, because the accuracy of 2 days is what we have now at 5 days. So that's why I don't like going out with any kind of specifics really beyond 5 days even.
And we talked a little bit about the 7-day, but let's look to the future.
Sure.
Because we're going to fast forward now with all the technology, satellites and so on, all the models that you get. Will we ever see the accurate 14-day? I mean, is that coming sometime? Or?
It could. Here's what the limiting factor is, the computing power and also the database. To give you an idea of the computer power needed to run these models, a 5-minute forecast in one of the models uses 336 million pieces of data in that. So you can imagine the immense amount of data that actually goes into this. So you need very fast computers, supercomputers, or chains of computers, basically, to process the data. But to get a perfect forecast, you need to know the weather everywhere horizontally and everywhere vertically. We don't have the ability to do that right now. We've got weather observations, when you see how far apart they are. One's at Milwaukee, one's at Waukegan, one's at Rockford. But vertically, it's even, the spacing is even greater. Vertically, our upper air stations, we don't have one in Chicago. We've got one in Green Bay. We've got one in Lincoln, Illinois, and one in Dubuque. What do you have to do to try to figure out the upper air conditions in Chicago? You have to interpolate the data and guesstimate, basically, what the data is in Chicago. So horizontally, but also on a time basis. Those balloons only go up every 12 hours. So if you want to know where they go up, one goes up at 7 a.m., one goes up at 7 p.m. In the summer, 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. in the wintertime here. And if you want to know what it is at noon, you've got to guess, And so when you put guesses in, that's where you start getting errors in the models.
Mm-hmm.
So the database has to become finer, and the computer power has to be strong enough to process that data. Even in the fast computers we have today, the weather balloons are launched at 6 a.m. I won't get the model data complete from the global model, which I use for long-range forecasting, for about 4 or 5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You would think it would be quicker, wouldn't you?
Yes,
I would. But when you're talking 336 million pieces of data in every 5-minute step, you can kind of get an understanding of how long this would really take. So there has to be greater computing power and a better database to do that. But I do think you'll continue to get, as long as the funding continues to do these improvements, you'll continue to see improvements in forecasting. We're to say today we have 5 days, maybe in 10, 15 years, it'll be out 7 or 8 days,
What is the most rewarding aspect of being a meteorologist?
Well, for me, it's I've been very fortunate. I was able to actually work in my hobby,
Yeah.
It's a hobby.
Yeah.
Me.
Yeah.
To me, is there's never a day that's the same in weather, and even if it's the weather's the same here, you can go find some interesting weather going somewhere else. So it's always changing, and so there's always a potential for that adrenaline rush.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, Eric, thanks for being on the program today.
Well, thanks for having me, Jim.
Really, really enjoyed it. Thank you. If you wish to contact Eric Priest, Professor of Meteorology, go to the CLC website, www.clcillinois.edu. And thank you for tuning in. I hope you drop by again next Thursday at 11 a.m. when we talk to another captivating guest on Word of Mouth.